so of your time to think together about this great letter, this ancient letter that has had such an influence on Western civilization and individual lives for nearly 2,000 years. C.S. Lewis had a rocky road to Christian faith. He's the man who wrote the famous books like the Screwtape Letters and the Narnia series, which many of you would be familiar with. He became a Christian in his 30s as a junior professor at Oxford, and had an unusual path back to the faith that he had in some ways grown up in. And he faced a set of problems that were, I think of as quite different, although having talked to people, they're familiar to people today. He had a problem with the problem of pain, the problem of suffering, which is a problem and a difficulty for many of us. But he also identified a problem that was a real barrier between him and traditional Christian belief, which was the problem not of pain, but what he called the problem of praise. And reflecting back on this problem as a Christian adult, he reflected on how this problem for him, that God wanted praise, that God wanted worship, had formed for him a barrier between him and Christian belief. Why does God want or need our praise? What is the character of a person who demands such a thing? What are the virtues, or what is the essence of a being that calls on other beings to praise him? That was the problem, and we'll have a little think about that over our lunch. But we're looking today at this book of Romans, particularly this opening chapter, which is printed for you on your outline. There's passage itself on one side and the outline of where we're going on the other. The context for the chapter that we start into this week, Justin set up for us last week if you were here. The problem that the book of Romans addresses is the problem of the righteousness of God. And for a Jewish person in the third century, that cashed out in three ways. Firstly, will our God, thinking as a Jewish person, will our God be shown to be just, to be righteous? As you look at the world and look at the way God is treated, will he show himself to be just? Secondly, can I be just? Can I be made righteous? If the God of all the world is righteous, can I be in the right relationship with him? And thirdly, the question that a Jewish person has in the first century is, will the world be put to rights? Will God be shown to be righteous or just? Can I be just before a just God? And will God justify, you know, on your Word document, you justify a border, which means you make it everything line up under the other thing. The Jewish hope was that God would do to the world what we do to our Word documents, justify it, bring it all into its proper shape again with everything in its right place. Paul begins by answering these questions about righteousness and justice with these words: the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth in their wickedness. Now, for a piece of cultural locatedness, it turns out that for most of human history and for many cultures today, the hardest thing about the gospel is the forgiveness of God, that God would wipe away sins and forgive people and not demand justice. For many people, that's a real problem with the gospel, but I take it for most of us. A bigger problem is those words just there, the justice of God expressing itself in the wrath or the anger of God. I think there's many reasons for having trouble with the idea of the wrath or anger of God. I think there's a very simple one. It's not the only one, but a very simple one is simply that we don't live in a war zone. If you've lived in Perth for the last little while, you get to live in a city that's relatively peaceful. Many of us live in suburbs where, at least on a week-to-week basis, the problem of manifest evil doesn't confront us. Of course, it happens behind closed doors and in private and small ways. But not living in a war zone means that hearing about the wrath of God strikes us somewhat as a bolt out of the blue. But I guess even us, in the relative comfort of Western culture, are occasionally confronted with something that demands a response of wrath or anger. A few years ago, I was very moved, as you would have been if you'd read it, as some of you may have, the story of James Byrd. Nearly 10 years ago, I think it was in Texas. He was a young black man, the father of two children, and he was coming home. He'd stopped by to give a lift to two young men who were hitchhiking on a, the back of a Texas street. And the men turned out to be white supremacists of a kind of a horrible little group in Texas. They took him behind a convenience store, they beat him, they stripped him naked, chained him to the back of their truck and drove until he died. It's unspeakable as you read the reports of the actual causes of the man's death. And Paul begins defending the justice of God by saying that the wrath of God is being revealed against all unrighteousness. So what Paul is saying is that, to use that vivid example, in the case of a situation like that of James Byrd, young man, two children, dragged behind a truck to his death, God looks at a world like that and one of his responses is anger. And when you think about it like that, one of my responses to the situation of James Byrd is anger. And I don't think that's the worst part of me. In fact, I think it's the better part of me that sees that situation and thinks, that makes me angry. And I'm sure it's the better part of you that responds to that kind of evil with anger. And the Bible is saying that God is like that. The Bible says that the wrath of God, the anger of God and injustice is being revealed against all wickedness. And Paul goes on to outline a very unusual but fascinating way of seeing this dynamic of God's anger against injustice and the way it cashes out in human lives. He says that human beings respond by suppressing the truth in their wickedness. He says the human situation is partly a response of suppression. And what is it that we suppress? We're told it's the truth about God, since what may be made known about God, around sentence 5, his invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, been understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Paul begins this whole argument by saying that the person that doesn't know God is a myth. It's a strong claim, but think about the claim for a moment. Paul says that if you look at the world, you can derive certain things about God. He's not saying that anyone could look at the world and derive a doctrine of the atonement or the Trinity or a doctrine of the church or anything like that. It's a modest account, but he is saying that anyone ought to be able to look at the creation and conclude that there is a God who has great power and is not like us. Now, that's not Christian faith. You're not a Christian the moment you believe that God has great power and is not like us. Many people believe something like that. But Paul says that this at least ought to be concluded from our experience of creation. If I can put it this way, atheists don't believe in God, and God here returns the compliment. God doesn't believe in atheists either. Psychologists tell us that suppression is a very unsuccessful strategy for dealing with issues in life. Similar in many ways to trying to suppress a balloon to the bottom of a swimming pool, sooner or later it will come up in some form or other. And Paul goes on to say that this suppression of the knowledge of God, seeing that God must be real and powerful, we push that down as humans and it comes up in strange new places. So he goes on to say that despite knowing God, Paul says, we refuse to give him thanks or treat him as God. But instead of thanking nothing, instead of worshipping nothing, we end up exchanging the worship of God for something really strange. He says, sentence 15, they exchange the truth of God for a lie and worship and serve created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. You see, when humans cease to worship the living God, it's not that they don't worship anything, it's that they will worship everything. Humans are hardwired for worship. Paul says that concludes in the worship of idols, and an idol, literally, in the language that Paul uses, is a carved image used as an object of worship. And the Bible takes time to think about this phenomena that is almost universal of worshipping carved images. In the Old Testament book of Isaiah, one of the largest books of the Old Testament, the prophet Isaiah tries to think it through, and there's quite a humorous passage in the Old Testament where Isaiah pictures someone who walks into a forest and cuts down a tree, And the craftsman chops it down, it falls down, he cuts it in half. Half of it he knocks up for kindling and for wood and lights a fire. And he says, ah, this is a good fire, it's making me warm. And with the other half he fashions a god. And Isaiah says, what is going on here? Isaiah says, back the truck up. You cut it down. He says, you're the one who knocked it in half. You're the one who turned half of it into a fire and felt the warmth. And now you've got the other half and you've carved it into an idol and you're saying, you are my God. And Isaiah says, sure, put it in an art gallery and write underneath, Eric made this. Because that's something that you did. You made it. So he says, if you made it, what are you doing now turning around and saying, thank you, you are my God. 10 seconds ago, it was a tree. And now you worship it. Idols are literally carved images. And the Bible sees that as an expression of our suppression of the true knowledge of God, that worship comes up in weird forms in worshipping idols. But the Bible does say that idolatry is bigger than that. Here's a definition of idolatry for you. Idolatry is when something smaller than you becomes bigger than you. Idolatry is when something that is smaller than you becomes bigger than you. You see that with the Isaiah thing, right? With the guy, Isaiah saying, man, you're better than that tree. You made it. Don't worship it. You're better than the thing that you made. But you see it all the time, I think, in our culture. As people go for significance and security and transcendence to things that are less than us. I think you see it vividly in addiction. If you've ever found yourself addicted to something or had a friend who had, it's a very powerful experience of something that's smaller than you, you know, a cigarette or a drink or an illicit drug. This thing that's less than you, humans made it and constructed it, but it comes to control you. You see it with things that seem otherwise innocent as, say, family. As family becomes the thing, not only the nourishing place where warm relationships are established, but the thing that gives you your significance and your security. You see it in study, as people study and study and study, not just to understand the world that God has made, but to find out who they are. You see it in career and materialism, where people look to career, look to their possessions, as something more than just the good gifts of a good God, but as something that is smaller than them, which becomes bigger than them. And what Romans chapter 1 is saying is that that's really, really bad. It's a really sad part of the human experience that human beings created to be such great and glorious creatures that we so debase ourselves and end up worshipping things that are less than us. So the response to God in the human situation is to suppress and then worship in a kind of weird way. And God responds. And notice how he responds by letting us have what we want. Remember the question, is the righteousness of God, can God be shown to be righteous? You look around the world and you see people worshipping anything other than the true and living God. And Paul says that is not an expression of the absence of God, but of the judgment of God in giving us over to what we want. Oscar Wilde once said, when the gods want to punish us, they answer our prayers. When the gods want to punish us, they answer our prayers. And here in Romans, Paul says something like that. So when God is expressing his anger, he lets us do what we want. Giving us over, giving us over, giving us over. Part of our response, humanity's response to God, is to suppress and to worship apart from him. And God says the words that you never want to hear as a human, eventually says, your will be done. Well, I want to try and bring this together and see if we have a couple of minutes for question time. We began by thinking about what's wrong with the world. And that's where Paul begins the letter of Romans. What is wrong with the world? And it's one of the fascinating parts of my job, speaking to people from outside the Christian faith about the Christian faith, that one thing that we seem to all share in common is some intuitive sense of the brokenness of the world, that there are things that are and that ought not be. And that is just a strange and fascinating thing, that we all seem to intuitively recognize that things are not how they ought to be. And Paul is helping us to think about the biblical answer for why that is so. And part of the answer is that we have suppressed the knowledge of God and in the process ended up worshipping things that are less than us, things that enslave us, and hearts that want to worship God end up determined to worship anything but. Now, when C.S. Lewis became a Christian, as I say, one of the things that troubled him was the problem of praise. Why does God want praise? Why does God need to hear from us about how great he is? And C.S. Lewis, I'm going to quote from him now. He says that I don't want my dog to bark in approval of my books. I don't need that kind of thing. Why does God need it? And on reflection, he said this. C.S. Lewis, I quote, "What I had never noticed is that all enjoyment spontaneously overflows into praise. The world rings with praise. Lovers praise their mistresses. Readers their favourite poet. Walkers praise the countryside. Players praise their favourite games. The praise of weather, wine, dishes, actors, motors, horses, colleges, countries, historical personages, children, flowers, mountains, rare stamps, rare beetles, even sometimes politicians or scholars. Except when intolerable circumstances interfere, praise is an almost inner health made audible. I had not noticed that just as men spontaneously praise whatever they value, so they spontaneously urge us to join in the praise of those things. Isn't she lovely? Wasn't that glorious? My whole difficulty," says C.S. Lewis, "about the praise of God depended on my absurd denying to us, as regards the supremely valuable, what we delight to do and can't help doing about everything else that we value. I think we delight to praise what we enjoy because the praise is not merely expressing but actually completes the enjoyment. It is its appointed consummation. It's not out of compliment that our lover keeps telling us how lovers keep telling one another how beautiful they are. The delight is incomplete till it's expressed. And it's frustrating to have discovered a new author and not to be able to tell someone how good they are. I've experienced that. Seeing a film by yourself, reading a book, and think, I want to tell someone else. I want to invite someone else into this experience of praise. To turn up the road upon some mountain valley of unexpected grandeur, and then to keep silent because the people you're with don't care for it any more than a can in the ditch. To hear a good joke and to find no one to share it with." C.S. Lewis resolved the problem of praise by understanding that the invitation to turn from idols to God is not an invitation to debase ourselves, but to complete ourselves, to be put right with God, to discover that we were made for his praise and glory. We're just at the beginning of this great book, but preempt the argument, Paul essentially says that worship got us into this mess, and worship can get us out of it. If our problem is the false and suppressed worship of things that do not deserve our allegiance, then the way forward is to rediscover the God who does. And that's what we'll be going over the next few weeks. Now, I have finished in enough time, I think, to field questions or comments, and then Paul can wrap up for us. Are there any questions or comments they wanted to make about this passage? Yes.
Sure. From sentence 5, since creation, God's invisible qualities have been understood, I've seen men without excuse. A little person in the jungle is often getting a common question, can they find God? Can they say it?
Yeah, I think this is one of the Bible's most important answers to that question, which is to say that you will not be judged for what you did not or could not know. So there's no one in the jungles of wherever who's being compared and contrasted with a doctrine in theology and saying you're on exactly the same terms. The Bible says you're only judged according to what you did or could know. But what the Bible is saying is that what we do with what we did or could know does not look good. So it's saying that even at that minimal level of eternal power and divinity, humans across the world respond very poorly to that bit of information. Paul says that you should be able to at least conclude from that you shouldn't worship idols. You should somehow say to that God, and perhaps someone in a jungle somewhere has said to that God, I don't know who you are, but I'm not going to worship this. I want to worship you. And Paul's saying that, as a rule, that is not what happens. And that's what God would respond to someone for whom it did happen. But I think that's essentially what he's saying. Yeah, you're not judged by what you couldn't know, judged by what you do know. And he's saying that what we do with what we do know is not good, which is seen from those of us who really do know, who come across God's revelation in Jesus and still push that away. It only accelerates the problem. All right, you've got jobs to go to or lunches to secure. So I'll be back next week to keep talking with you about this.